connecting our university city
and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon and happy new year. Thanks to our man in the stand, Ollie Soccer Slack, for the last hour. And now Cambridge 105 Radio brings you Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman, with a look back at the flavours of 2018.
Last year, we ran 145 features, and that's up from 142 in 2017. And we had 25 news sections and 23 Twitter news updates. And today, we bring you a small selection of what we covered. A flavour of flavour, you might say.
And last year we welcomed some new voices to flavour. Louise Wilson, Rosie Applin, Steve Hovington, Carrie Pavitt and Liz Budd. More from them this year.
We also welcome some outstanding new names to the Cambridge food scene, such as Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern, Alex and Sam Carter of Restaurant 22 and, all too briefly, Samira Effer at Alimentum. Between them, they brought about a significant increase in the number of quality restaurants in the city. And we spoke with Tristan Welch on the 17th of March when he told us something of the chefs he's previously worked with.
Gordon Ramsay and Marcus Ware, two amazing men. Marcus is a great sort of technician.
What, precision, that sort of thing?
Absolute precision. Mm. Absolute precision. Gordon is complete drive. Power, a tour de force sort of thing. And in real life, the passion just oozes out of him, like it oozes out the TV, but even like 10 times more, even not 100 times more sort of thing.
Yeah.
Two great men that I've taken so much from. I'm super lucky in that respect. I've had to work alongside some great men.
They both have the reputation of being, let's say, quite difficult if you don't come up with the goods.
Complete nutters, yeah. Well, absolutely. And I did come from that background.
So what's that done to your sort of, let's say, management style?
Oh, fried my brains, I tell you. Fried my brains. But what it's done, actually, is taken me on an amazing journey from the point of where I've been there. I've chopped suey the whole kitchen before, you know, and you've seen the damage it has on people's lives and all that sort of thing. You see the damage it has on the food. The best time I've ever cooked is when everyone's happy and everyone's focused, and I think that really comes across in the food. And I couldn't imagine working in a place where it's like a madhouse sort of thing. I couldn't imagine that. I couldn't imagine working in an environment where it's violent and nasty and horrible. Now I laugh and I joke in the kitchen. I think we get on way better. We have way much more fun. Life's too short to start doing that sort of stuff again. No, different kettle of fish now. Different kettle of fish. I tell you what really changed it for me is living and working out in the Caribbean. If you act like, you see, Gordon and Marcus would have acted on the TV in the Caribbean. Nothing would get done. Nothing would get done. So you have to change your spots a little bit when you're faced with that. And I think it's taught me to lighten up, have a great time, enjoy what you're doing. And from that comes great food, great service, and hopefully a great glass of wine after service too.
Tina Roche and Liz Young of the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro ran a series in which they spoke with chefs and food writers. Here is a mini mashup of their chats with Alex Rushmer, Samira Effer, Tristan Welch, who you heard just now, and Alex and Sam of Restaurant 22.
I love doing radio because you don't have to wear any clothes.
Well, we appreciate it too.
Well, we are Swedish, aren't we?
That is lovely, isn't it? Such a lovely texture. The meat is so tender. So what are your food memories then, mainly from Scandinavia, Alex?
My friends were always, I think when you're a child, what you don't get on a daily basis suddenly becomes something that you yearn for. And Mum always used to cook Swedish food, and my friends were always keen to come over and have Swedish meatballs and lingonberry and mashed potato and salmon and all these things that were suddenly very exotic. Mm. And for me, it was everyday food and a lot of boiled potatoes, boiled carrots. But my friends were always so keen to come over and eat, and I was always so keen to go over and eat potato waffles and beans and sausages.
My dad used to come home with, like from Nigeria, he used to come home with like these massive snails or something like that. He wasn't allowed to bring them through, but somehow...
Snails, were they still alive after the journey?
Yeah, they were still alive, and I just have this vision in my head. We were eating snails and I was young, so that's probably one of my earliest memories of him cooking.
Persistency gets you there, though, doesn't it? Just ringing, nagging, yes. In a way, in a nice way.
That's what I tell my wife, yes.
Yeah.
And working in that environment where it's quite intense, it's Michelin star, it's five rosettes, I believe, and it's hard work, but really learned a lot, yeah.
Yep, I'm from just outside Cambridge, and Cambridge is where it really started for me, actually. My first job was working for Gay Roads in London.
Oh, I see, tell us.
And he was on tour, and he did a date at the Corn Exchange. Like a groupie, I was a young college student in those days. I hung around and I wanted his autograph. I got a bit of an expose. I can tell you how he kept that hair.
Oh, we'd love to know.
Would you like to know?
Yes, please.
Weller hair gel.
Taking a good ingredient and showcasing it is what I've sort of carried on.
Mm, not complicating it too much.
Nice. Yeah, nice and simple.
One of them is like deep fried truffle macaroni cheese and everyone just loves it.
It's a bit of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Wow, that does sound amazing.
Yeah, it's really yummy. Yeah.
Which so cheeses are you using in that pan?
Aged Comté.
Comté is just the best.
It's quite Moorish. It's Moorish.
Yes.
I think that's a lot of my career. I'm just doing what feels right and what I feel comfortable doing.
So when someone walks in and you know that they have that sort of coffee, to me, if you're making that coffee for them as soon as they open the door, that's how I would want it.
One of the features we ran was called Guilty Food Secrets. Here are the secrets of local chef Rosie Sykes, Guardian food writer Rachel Roddy, who took part in the Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival last year, and Stephen Marsh of Pinkster Gin.
Rosie, have you got any guilty food secrets?
Well, I have quite a few, I think, but I would say my main one is tinned semolina or tinned macaroni, the sweet, I think it's Ambrosia does a range of cream, like milk puddings, really old fashioned. And that would be one of my guilty pleasures. Just warmed up with some jam plopped in it, like at school. But my other one would be a peanut butter and cucumber sandwich on really soft white bread. I think that counts, does it?
What's your guilty food secret, Rachel?
I don't generally feel very guilty. I'll tell you what I do feel guilty, it shouldn't, is that my son, everyone says to me, Luca must eat so brilliantly. And actually, when I'm recipe testing, him and Vincenzo, they eat whatever I am testing. So if I'm testing, you know, two jam tarts and a chocolate cake, both of which that have gone wrong, that is their tea. So I feel slightly guilty about my son's premature tooth decay. But
Well, my guilty food secret, actually, I really like Mars bar vodka. And you make Mars bar vodka by putting vodka in a jam jar, half full of jam jar with vodka, chop up a Mars bar, put the chopped up Mars bar in the jam jar, put the lid on tight, put it in the dishwasher.
In the dishwasher?
In the dishwasher.
Oh, wow.
And let it go through a cycle, take it out, shake it, and put it through another cycle. And when it's been through the second cycle, take it out, let it cool. Perhaps then, when it's cooled, put it in the freezer. And you have an absolutely delicious Mars bar vodka.
That sounds so naughty.
It is.
We have made Skittle vodka, and frankly, that was not worth making. But
no.
Mars bar vodka sounds brilliant.
That is my guilty food secret.
Thank you. I love it. Thank you.
Another feature was our food of the fortnight. Here are Alex Rushmer and Rosie Sykes with some ideas for celeriac, a vegetable that they highly recommend.
It has just the most incredible flavour. It's sort of slightly ethereally, almost aniseed-y, but very, very subtle. So good for people that don't like fennel. Spoon some brown butter all over the top. So put it in a pan. Add some brown butter to the pan and spend about 15-20 minutes just spooning the brown butter over the celeriac, and then cover it and put it in a low oven, 120-130 degrees for probably about 3 or 4 hours. It takes a while to cook through. But what you end up with is this amazing nut brown, delicious, savoury exterior, and then the flesh inside almost steams. And if you want to finish it in a pan, again, with a little bit more butter, but as an accompaniment to game is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And it's a dish that I first had at the Hand and Flowers, actually, Tom Carriage's pub over in Marlow. I had a roast chicken that had been flavoured with hops and hay. And then this amazing celeriac about the size of a cricket ball, but perfectly round, perfectly spherical, and as an accompaniment to the chicken, with the roasted chicken juices in there and those flavours of those lovely autumnal flavours of hops and hay and barley and malt, and it was just a fantastic combination. But again, very, very simple. But I think with ingredients like that, you don't need to do an awful lot to it. It's about celebrating almost the simplicity of the ingredient, which is what I try and achieve through my cooking.
Yes, so celeriac, I would say, is one of my favourite winter vegetables. It's fantastic to make a mash with. I find that if you want to mash it for it to be nice and solid without having to add potato or something, it's really great to bake. So I don't bother to peel it. I just cut it into quarters, wrap each quarter in foil and bake it like a potato until it's really, really soft. Make sure you put some salt and olive oil in. Then the skin, you can take off a nice thin layer of the skin and just put it in your food processor with some creme fraiche or some butter or olive oil, depending on what you like. And what I really like about celeriac mash is that it's got a lot of flavour, but it's super light, so it's not, doesn't feel heavy with a meal. It goes beautifully with game or pork, or most meats actually, and it's a lovely vegetarian option as well. You could sort of sprinkle it with some nuts and perhaps put an egg into it and bake it, and it's almost like a sort of unformed souffle, which would be a nice thing for a vegetarian. And the other thing I love doing with celeriac is making a gratin, which is very simple, really. It sounds a bit more scary than it is, but it's lovely with mushrooms. So maybe sauté off some mushrooms, peel a celeriac, slice it, toss it in some milk and cream with salt and some aromats, and layer up the celeriac and the sautéed mushrooms, pour over the cream, cover it and bake it in the oven, and you'll get a lovely result.
For about an hour?
Yeah, probably about an hour. Mm. Just until a knife goes in, about, you know, sort of mid-temperature, 180, something like that.
Mm, Rosie Sykes there. And if you want even more celeriac ideas, today's Feast magazine in The Guardian, Anna Jones has root veg stew with celeriac dumplings and celeriac soup with spicy nut sprinkle. But on to other food writers now. The Cambridge Literary Festival's session with Felicity Cloak and Nikki Sennett was cancelled. Not to be deprived, Sue caught a fast train to London and tracked them down. And here they are, Felicity Cloak first, talking about how she got started in food writing.
I actually started off in publishing, nothing to do with food really, art publishing actually. I left because I really wanted to write myself. Food was one of the things that I was interested in. I don't have any formal cookery training. What I love about food is that you can write about so many different topics. There's travel, there's history, there's science. So I fell into it really. I just have always loved writing.
What got you started writing for The Guardian?
And actually it came about by chance, because I ended up, I was working for magazines at the time, food magazines, and I went on a trip. This was in the glory days before the financial crash, when, you know, people, tourist boards would send journalists away on trips to write articles. And I went to Las Vegas to write about the culinary revolution there. So it was sort of an interesting time, lots of big chefs from around the world setting up there. And I was on the trip with a woman from The Guardian who was so cynical about all of this. It's brilliant. She was really good fun. And we ended up having a really, you know, great time, lots of interesting chats. And when we came back, we stayed in touch, and she asked me if I'd write something sort of on the side, moonlight for her. Mm. And I was so delighted by the idea of writing for my favourite paper that I thought she said that she would pay me £5 for an article. I was happy to do it for £5. Later, I find out it was £85, which still isn't a king's ransom, but was slightly better. But I would have done, I probably would have paid her £5 to be in The Guardian at the time. Mm-hmm. So it's worked out nicely for me, my favourite paper.
And was it your idea to do the perfect analysis of dishes?
No, I'd like to say it was, because it's a really great idea. But in fact, it came about by accident. So the series started off as about looking at food myths. So things like, if it's true, you shouldn't wash mushrooms. You know, whether there's any, you know, truth in the notion of sealing meat before you cook it. All of that stuff. Then it evolved. We did one about the best way to cook a sausage. You know, all the accompanying jokes about pricks with forks, etc. And it went, Matt, it was online, and the comments underneath went wild because British people love to talk about sausages, turned out. So we thought, well, we're onto something here. So the next week we did how to cook mash. And again, I mean, we love mash. And then that's when it became the series that it became. So it probably had about 3 months of being something a little bit different, but then this worked. I mean, we hit upon something, and it's been going ever since, which is 8 years ago.
And now Nikki Senyet explaining the basis of her new book, Lateral Cooking.
If you are, you know, if you're making a creme caramel and it's a baked custard made of milk and whole eggs, then if you make the same kind of basic baked custard but you use just yolks and cream, then you make a creme brulee. Then you completely understand what the yolk and what the white and what the milk and what difference does it make to use those kind of things. So when you look at I'm quite interested in looking at people's recipes and then deconstructing them, knowing exactly what I know now, I can see that the reason that Marcus Waring's custard tart is a 5-star gold award winner is because it's a creme brulee set in a pastry case. Of course, that's going to be much nicer than, you know, your nan's, you know, milk and a couple of eggs.
Made with skim milk, possibly.
Grey skim milk.
Yeah.
So, and then in order to plot them on the continuums and make them as useful as possible, so taking custard again as an example, I had to bring everything in line with each other as much as possible, make one point constant where possible. So in the custard section, everything is 250ml or 500ml of milk or cream, and that way it makes it easier for the user or the reader to understand how the different ingredients are working in relation to each other. And in fact, you know, once you've got a couple of those basic ideas in your head about custard, it's very easy to go off and make any kind of baked custard or quiche or, you know, to riff on bread and butter pudding, all those kind of things that are custard-based meals. You only need to know how much egg it takes to set the milk and how much, you know, and what heat, you know, to keep the heat down with all custards unless you put flour in it. Kind of once you know that, off you go. Yeah. And then you can start, you know, it's not always going to work out if you start pushing the boundaries. But, I mean, certainly, as far as custard's concerned, really useful thing to know. You know, you can start to get creative with it, because the great thing about custard is it's very amenable to all sorts of flavours and additions and twiddling around, which sometimes we want to do.
Yes, you do. Rachel Roddy, who writes a regular column in the Guardian's Feast section, talked to me earlier in the year about how she got started with her writing, which she began with a blog.
I mean, I'd never heard of a blog, but a friend of mine who worked for an online fashion magazine said, start a blog and start writing. And I mean, you write, you post, and there's no one reading. I mean, not even my mum, because I didn't even tell my mum I was doing it. But there was a massive community of American bloggers, which I think some people can be kind of, you know, a little bit funny about. Maybe some of them weren't so good. I mean, I've always thought blogs are closer to kind of scrapbooks or personal diaries, but there was a big, thriving American network of mostly women, young women, writing about food. And I just joined in. And I, you know, you talk to bloggers and it's a bit like, you know, you read them and they read you. It's very reciprocal. And then, but then people were starting to emerge and people were starting to write for magazines and get book deals. So I was very much on that wave. And I was a little bit of ashamed of it as well, because, you know, I would read all these serious English food writers and I felt that I was doing something that was deeply inferior. But it was my way of, because of course you're just writing and then you learn to edit and you get feedback.
Yeah.
So I look back at with a lot of affection, actually. Lots of people writing not very well, and, you know, paragraphs and paragraphs about their kind of day, but yet there were some wonderful things some real gems. I say a lot of people went on to write books, so that's how I started.
And did The Guardian pick you up from your blog then? Is that how they got to know about you?
It was Felicity Cloak, and she was doing How to Do the Perfect Something, and she came and read my blog. By that point, a few people had said it was, I realised that there was I had things to write about, I had material, I was enjoying writing it, and people were enjoying reading. So it's Felicity, yes, and The Guardian were very supportive.
So she was doing one of her pieces in which she researches different cooks' ways of doing food.
And stumbled on me.
And so she stumbled on you via Google or what have you.
Probably, and then wrote a link to me, and then The Guardian, and that by that point also somebody had suggested that maybe I'd got a lot of writing, self-induct, but loads and loads and loads of blog posts. And someone suggested that maybe there could be a book in there if I got a very good editor.
Another writer we featured on the programme was Cambridge's B. Wilson. B was a guest at the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro interviews, and here she is, speaking with Tina Roche and Liz Young in our programme from the 12th of May about her book, First Bite. All these shows are available, by the way, on podcast if you missed them the first time round.
So I'm an only child, and I never had to compete for food with any siblings, and I found your description of the dinner table sort of power place between you and your two-year-old older sister fascinating.
Yeah, that other person sitting at the table affects you and how you eat in all these ways that we somehow don't talk about and don't think about. There were things I kind of hadn't thought about for years about the extent to which my eating was formed by her. So one of the things I wrote about was that when she was a teenager, she became anorexic. And it was this terrible thing that this person I'd previously been sharing plates of spaghetti bolognese with, well, latterly not, because she'd gone vegetarian before she became anorexic, suddenly just was there with an empty plate. And I became a compulsive eater as a teenager. And I hadn't really examined until I wrote that book the extent to which that was clearly a reaction. It was partly my parents really were desperate for someone to feed, and I was really happy to be that baby bird sitting in the nest with my mouth gaping open, ready to have worms ferried in. But it also felt like it was a reaction against my sister, and it was sort of, we'd always had sibling rivalry going along. She had a rabbit, I had a guinea pig. She underate, I overate. And it's not as simple as that.
But you're also suggesting that maybe you also did it to somehow, you felt sorry for your parents to a degree. You were aware of their anxiety over the one daughter who wasn't eating, and therefore you thought that you could be the good one and maybe ease that worry and that pain a bit.
I think it was that. I was somehow trying to compensate, because it's an awful dynamic. Any family that's seen anyone go through anorexia, to see someone that you love wasting away is terrible. I mean, it's obviously more terrible for her. I'm not trying to say being the person living with an anorexic, but it's eating disorders are so complex. And one of the things I just wanted to examine is how all of our experiences with food are formed by those first family moments. You know, as babies, whether we're only children or whether we have siblings, we're given both love and food at the same time when our mothers feed us with milk. And so it's no wonder that when we're adults, we sometimes have trouble disentangling whether sugar is actually love or something else.
We continue to review new food books in 2018. One which very much caught Alan's eye was Black Sea by Carolyn Eden. Here's Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille talking about it with Alan on the 27th of November.
It's a book about food and travel. It's a piece of food writing from the very first moment that I read her manuscript. I just thought this is absolutely incredible, the depth of research and knowledge in it, not just of food, but of the places that Caroline visits. She goes through the Slavic lands, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Romania, and she goes to Turkey. And she goes through some areas that have had, gone through really appalling times, and how, in a way, it was a journey through darkness and light. And those themes are reflected in the recipes and the food, interestingly. By the time you get to sort of Mediterranean Turkey, the food's very, very different. And actually, I was quite surprised learning about the food in Bulgaria. It's much more sort of brighter and fresher and Mediterranean than I actually expected.
Yes, well, one of the Bulgarian recipes struck me. She says that Bulgaria has a love affair with roses, which, I didn't know. So there's a recipe for poached apricots in rose water, which does sound terribly nice.
Lovely, isn't it? Yeah. But all the ingredients that she used in the book are very, they're very basic in a way. They're very sort of humble. They do reflect the dishes that would be cooked there, but you don't need any sort of specialist ingredients. It's all very easy to get hold of. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the food and the recipes are lovely, but the book is so much more. It's she just transports you with her writing to these places I haven't visited, I would love to visit. Caroline's a travel writer, and in fact she used to be a bookseller at Waterstones back in the day. And she travels all over the world, but I think she has a particular love for this area of the world. And we just talked a lot about how interest in food is heading towards that area. If you think of maybe when people were buying cookbooks in their droves sort of 25 years ago, the emphasis was on Italian, probably Italian, French. And then we've gone gradually sort of eastward, particularly in recent years. And I also think that interest will be heading kind of slightly northward as well. Scandinavia, of course, huge influence on the way people cook these days. So Black Sea was just, it's an attempt to explore a region that probably most people don't know anything about the food there. I mean, certainly I wasn't very knowledgeable about it before working on the book.
No, and what you said about the fact that there aren't any exotic ingredients, it's accessible to us all, is very true.
Right. That is an excellent book, Black Sea by Caroline Eden. And did you have a favourite book this year, Sue?
Well, I would certainly say Lateral Cooking, which I purchased and read in relation to doing the interview with Nikki. But also, I've just been given for Christmas an amazing book called The Hungry Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World, which is by Lizzie Collingham, who is a local historian and food writer. And hopefully I'll be interviewing her later this year.
Mm. Jolly good.
And that music signals, of course, time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, there's been quite a few. Brew Board in Harston are open now, up until 6 o'clock. They've got lots of beers and freshly cooked pies as well, so no doubt Matt will be along there. And at Thirsty in Chesterton Road, Meatless is there with its, will be there from 6 till 9 tonight with a completely vegan menu. Cambridge Cookery and Bistro has Joe Krajinska afternoon teas on cakes, and Joe has tweeted a photo of a very nice looking gooey chocolate cake with white chocolate buttercream. So that's that's there now. Steak and Honour are celebrating 2 years of their Wheeler Street restaurant today, and they're open until 10 o'clock tonight. And Navadanya in Newmarket Road has one or two tables available this evening. One of the biggest issues facing us is the effects of our activities on the planet. Food production is a major cause of pollution, be it methane gas from the back end of cows and from rice paddies, or the plastics used, usually unnecessarily, to wrap food. And here on Flavour, we looked at ways of reducing our impact on the environment. One is to grow your own. It reduces food miles, and unless you buy plastic bags of compost, it reduces the use of plastic too. But there are times of the year when fresh food from the vegetable garden just isn't there. Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments in Foster Road talked in February about getting things going earlier.
As for crops in the ground, yes, you can give them a little bit of extra warmth by covering them with a cloche, for example. So that's a bit more effort, but and they're still susceptible to slugs and snails and maybe other dangers. Perhaps even more so under a cloche, because you can't see so easily what's going on. When you go around checking for pest damage, it's more effort to get the cloche off and have a close look.
What about putting some black material over the top before they've germinated? Or will that make any difference?
Yeah, so you can try warming the soil. I mean, the way I do it is I've got some old secondary double glazing panels which I put over beds to heat them up, so there's a little bit of a greenhouse under there. Black plastic, I guess, would have the same effect, yeah, because it's going to absorb the sunlight. So that might make a little bit of difference, yeah.
Yeah. What about manure? As manure is rotting, it's presumably heat is being generated.
When you've spread that over the ground, I think the heating effect is going to be negligible.
So that's not a...
I don't think so. Well, no, I mean, unless you really want to use the old Victorian technique But this is in a, when you've got a grand house and a team of 100 gardeners and a lot of horses around. So there they would grow exotic crops, I mean, the pineapple being the pinnacle of this. But they would be in glass houses, which were indeed heated by massive stacks of manure. So yeah, actually, you can make a hotbed. I did that once. So you build a large bottomless box, maybe about the size of a compost bin, and stack that with manure and perhaps some carbon-rich material, given that the manure is sort of high nitrogen. So mix that in, and we're talking fresh manure here. Build that up as much as you've got, and then top it off with a foot of topsoil or compost, and then sow your carrots or your other early crops in January, and then sort of, you know, wait for it to warm up, and hopefully the timing of the exothermic compost under manure underneath is going to be the right time to get those seeds germinated. So it can be done. I did that and it worked, but the small crop of carrots that I got in May, as opposed to getting carrots in the conventionally in June, was probably not worth it.
You know, it's the production of food and drink that generates a lot of waste too. But as Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street told us, there are ways of reducing wastage by putting it to good use.
So one of my first interests in beer was when I was running a community garden in Clapton. We were blessed with many top breweries where we were collecting the waste from and turning that into compost. So when my brothers first started telling me about his idea to set up a brewery, I was like, cool, so what we can do with the waste? Mm. And so when we finally arrived at brewing, we got a cargo bike and mimicked what I was doing in London, using cycle power to take the waste from the brewery to the allotment and managing to achieve the best compost because it's full of nitrogen and nutrients for plants. And you can grow big and healthy vegetables to enjoy. So it's giving second life to the waste. So that is basically something we do every brew day, cycled up to the New Street allotments, where it's benefiting many gardeners and chickens as well.
Waste can be reduced by eating parts of animals which are often thrown away or put into animal feed. Here's fishmonger Ben Roberts talking to Alan in February.
Ben, I see you've got boiled cod roe. Could you tell me what that is?
It's what it is. It's the roe from the cod. It's the eggs from the female cod. And this time of year, we've got them for best part of 2 months or so, really, when they're in prime condition. I sometimes bring them raw, but the best way, I think, to bring them is boiled. And you slice them, and you can eat them as they are, because they're already cooked, or you can just give them a quick pan fry to warm them through. And they're delicious. They go with anything.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What do they go best with? What do you like them with?
I get a bit naughty. I have them with a bit of bacon and some boiled potatoes, but you could have them with pasta, you could have them with rice. They really are very, very delicious.
And are they expensive?
No. They're one of the cheapest things I've got in the van. You know, it's cheaper than actually buying cod fillet. And considering it's only available for a short period of the year, it's a really good value meal.
Yeah. Isn't there a second type of cod roe?
There's the male equivalent, the chitlins, which is a sort of white, light-coloured, stringy thing, but I don't bring those because you don't really get them very often. Most of the time, they're either taken straight out and sent somewhere else.
Yes, what do you say, the equivalent? The sperm?
Yes,
or what?
Yes, that's it, yes. It's the male reproductive bit.
Is it a drink? Or?
No. It comes in, it's strange. It's sort of a big stringy mess. And, yeah.
Right. So who likes them then? Where do they go
I have
to?
No idea who likes them. They go into the continent. People on the continent eat
all
those.
Are they called chitlins? Or chitlins, at least they are
English. To me, yes.
Looks like you're not anxious to dash over to the continent to have some, Sue.
No, I don't think so.
Right, OK. As long as it's not overdone, foraging is a good way of reducing the environmental impact of food production, packaging and transportation. Here's some of Gemma Whiting's delicious ideas from Linton Kitchen. She spoke with us on the 26th of May.
Out of my own garden, there's lilacs, so you can just use the flowers to make lilac sugar, and then you've got a lovely flavoured jar of sugar.
Just mix it with sugar, or what?
Yep, you just take the flowers off and put them in a jar of sugar, as much or as little as you like, depends how. But I have violet sugar, lavender sugar, thyme sugar, lilac sugar, so it just adds, you know, you can do a Victoria sponge.
So the So the smell of the lilac is what the lilac sugar tastes of.
And you can make a violet, a lilac sugar syrup, and it's really nice in your gin and tonic.
Right. But you said you could also put it in the cake, the lilac sugar in the
sponge. I use lilac sugar in Victoria sponge. We also use a scented pelargonium, which is not so much foraged as propagated.
Yeah, what, the leaves?
The leaves. We use it in our strawberry and raspberry jam, and it's ever so delicious. It's just like a subtle citrusy rose fragrance, and it just gives like a different edge. Or you can line your tin with pelargonium leaves and bake a Victoria sponge, and then you just have this scented Victoria sponge. It's really subtle.
Gemma Whiting of Linton Kitchen there. Now, Stephen Marsh of Pinkster Gin has a very lucrative means of avoiding waste. Here he is explaining it to Sue.
We're very low. We have very, very low food miles, and we have absolutely no waste, because when I finish making Pinkster, I'm left with raspberries. What we do with the spent fruit is that we put the berries in jars and sell them as boozy berries. The berries that aren't good enough to go in jars, we turn into gin jam. And when we finish making the gin jam, the liquid the berries have been preserved in, we are now bottling and selling as Pinkster Royale. Now, that is and it is absolutely superb. A dash of Pinkster Royale in a glass of Prosecco.
So it's a bit like a sort of cassis idea.
Yes, absolutely. But it's a skinny cassis, because we don't add sugar. And we don't touch it, but a dash of that in a glass of Prosecco. The dryness of the Pinkster Royale complements the sweetness of the Prosecco. It's intensely raspberry.
It sounds gorgeous. And is this the new product that you've just literally launched?
Well, we launched it a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. We're 4 weeks ago. If somebody had said to me 6 months ago that I would have a third byproduct out of Pinkster, I wouldn't have believed them.
Another way of reducing waste, of course, is to use the Olio app.
Now that's our Olio official music. And on the Olio app today, Candice, who lives off Mill Road on the Romsey side, is offering Paxo golden breadcrumbs and Bisto onion gravy granules. I wonder if she listened to our last episode with the Tim Haywood quote about how much he loves stock cubes being thick, hot, brown, salty and abundant. Well, both Candice's offerings have a best before date of last year, but one is still sealed and both should be fine. Also, on Mill Road, on the Romsey side, Sedgwick Street to be exact, we have Alim, who is offering assorted package sandwiches. They expired on Friday, but they're still good for picking up today. He is available before 6 p.m. this evening. And lastly, Sung has a free bag of carrots, best before the 8th of January. She's in the very centre, near St Andrew's Church. Those carrots are available for pickup tonight after 7 p.m. And that is what is available on the Olio app, free food for pickup.
Very good. Cambridge 105 Radio is a community radio station staffed by volunteers, and we like to check out other community initiatives around the city and South Cambridgeshire too, and there are plenty of them.
Yeah, in April, I went along to the Empty Common Community Gardens. This is a big space that's open to everyone in order to plant, grow fruit, veg, flowers, or just be social.
We're just down the end of Brooklands Avenue, opposite the Botanic Garden. This garden is running alongside the conduit.
Yes, so there's Hobson's Conduit on one side, Vickers Brook on the other side. Mm. We're surrounded by water and trees.
Yes.
What could be better in the middle of Cambridge? Come and join. We're doing a radio thing.
The dog wants to sing a song.
Oh, the dog wants to sing a song.
Hello, you. She's really good with the community radio. She plays all sorts of instruments.
Not bad for a dog.
What a beautiful dog.
So Ian was instrumental in getting this garden going.
Oh, well, I know. I was just one of the individuals that encouraged the City Council to provide a space for the community to work collaboratively.
I mean, this was just a sea of mud 5 years ago.
You'll never grow in that area. Mm. It's waterlogged.
And it's lovely now. It's a proper place, yeah. Part of this garden is about promoting the ideas of permaculture, sustainable ways of doing things.
It's an incredible design. I'd love to slowly learn more about it, and especially how the plants are placed as well, because I'm sure that's very, really key around this garden. Yeah.
Look at nature and copy it a bit. Instead of trying to work over it, if we work with it, then life can be a lot easier. So that's why I'm involved with this garden, is to promote.
Not only a garden, it's a community garden.
That is the most important thing about it. And it's full of people who all do different things.
all these can go, yeah?
No, these must stay.
What are these?
You know, someone really likes sowing seeds, someone really likes digging. It makes the whole thing work better than it would as an individual. I mean, the sum is greater than...
The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's
definitely.
Yeah.
Do you know you can hear rhubarb growing?
I did not know that,
yeah.
No.
So you know when it's got those lovely, great, big, sort of tight buds, and they go... as they burst open a little bit more. Yeah.
Charlotte can do a range of impressions of different plant noises. Sweet peas are her best. The wild garlic noise. You make as well as
I'm not doing that one, not even for the radio.
I like the more you learn about all these different kind of plants, the more you realise that there's not really such thing as a weed.
If you want to come and join us, it's good to come on Sunday at 10:30 to meet everyone, because that's when we garden as a group.
So you don't have to do any work.
Yeah.
That's, you know, obviously people like pottering and working as well. You know, it's not as good opportunity just to come here and mix with people and just enjoy the space.
Mm.
You can find your little niche in the group, really. Mm. That's what it's about, so that you have your own ability to do what you're interested in.
Now, you know, it took about 3 weeks to put that feature together because almost every weekend it rained. Anyway, another volunteer-led initiative is Food for Food. Now, this is run by Winter Comfort for the Homeless. And at the end of last year's big summer heatwave, I met with manager Rachel Newell, who told me all about it.
We've kind of grown through word of mouth. I mean, we do a really good spread.
A really top quality store.
I think it's our busiest year so far for Food for Food.
Food for Food.
Food for Food, a catering business run by Winter Comfort.
OK, so I'm Liam Hares.
Liam's a catering supervisor.
He knows his staff.
I love the buffet.
I don't know, I just do them.
It's a wonderful place to work.
I thought I was only going to be here for a few months.
How long ago was that?
That was 5 years. 5 years ago, yeah.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes.
Yeah. I don't know how long we've been doing this Food for Food.
Food for Food has been around since 2009.
But it seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, it's an enterprise that they've set up to help homeless people.
They're learning how to cook, they're learning about food hygiene here at Winter Comfort.
I was actually the delivery driver last year for Food for Food. So you get that easy route into work, because obviously they're going to be a bit kinder to you. And then you raise yourself up, and maybe 3-4 months later, you've got the confidence maybe to move on into, you know, the proper world. But also, they have contacts with the proper world. Like, for instance, I work at St John's College because of Winter Comfort. So, yeah, it's all good stuff.
This is a perfect job for me because it's balancing those social and financial aims. You know, you need to be sustainable, you need to make money. We're totally owned by the charity, so any money goes back into the charity.
It seems to have a smart system going.
Hello, my name's Teresa, and I'm the kitchen assistant at Winter Comfort for Food for Food.
Hi, I'm Aidy. I'm the breakfast chef.
Teresa's the chatty one.
I've just started 6 months ago.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a newcomer.
Noisy newcomer.
A noisy newcomer.
Yeah, really good team, and they all support each other.
I mean, we all get on very well in the kitchen because there's always banter going on, you know, there's always, she's always laughing, we're always laughing. It's just a nice, friendly place to go, and the food's good.
Yeah. If it's...
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy.
This is exactly what I need. Thanks to this place, I can say that being homeless on the streets, I've actually started to gain weight.
I mean, I started doing things because I was homeless once, and the comfort helped me. So, payback.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just something I enjoy doing.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Yeah, really great setup they have there, and all the people were so obliging to talk to me, despite there being, you know, I was there during their breakfasts. That's Winter Comfort, and it's based near Chesterton Road.
And that's where we venture to next, with the reopening of Restaurant 22. A young couple, Alex and Sam, are doing great things there currently, and we caught up with them back in March, just days before they opened.
I think in terms of it operating as a restaurant, it's actually older than you guys, isn't it?
It was converted in 1982, we think. Ah. There's some etchings on the stained glass window at the front that have 1982 as the date. So we believe that when it was first converted to dining rooms, that etching was put on. So yes, it has been a restaurant longer than we've been on the planet, I suppose.
I would love to go back to the old house.
And your cooking will be ostensibly British?
Absolutely British. Our a la carte menu, which is a very small a la carte menu, so it's a three starters, three mains and three desserts. But the idea of keeping it small is keeping it fresh and keeping it regularly changing, weekly if not bi-weekly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be completely seasonal, so wild garlic, different mushrooms, the asparagus coming into season sort of April time, and that's the idea of it. We will also be doing a set lunch menu because Restaurant 22 has never been open at lunchtimes before. We have put together a set menu which is three courses, and the idea is to offer that and hopefully get a bit of business and trade at lunchtime, which is what it's never had here before. So this is Chesterton Room. The idea of up here is bespoke menus, graduation dinners, birthdays, christenings, small weddings possibly.
Yeah.
So your favourite food might be scallop, beef, souffle. And that's what we'll do. And we'll just use seasonal products and create a menu to work with.
You'll be head chef here. There'll be a team of chefs, I suppose, to accommodate everybody.
I've got myself head chef. I've got a sous chef moving down from Edinburgh. He's got a really good background, so he's been at Tom Aikins, Ted Sawyer in Australia. I met him working for Gordon Ramsay in London.
Ramsay's attempt at relaxing the staff isn't working.
How old are you?
24. Gordon.
24. And you can't cook an artichoke? Concentrate on keeping your job.
Well, stay here. Every time there's food on the pass.
It was a tough environment, very demanding, high pressure. The restaurant that was at Maze, it was Michelin star, but it was high volume as well.
Mm.
But not a lot of people do know about Restaurant 22. I mean, it's...
We found that there's quite a few people that do know about it, though, and who really love it.
Yeah.
We spoke to a lady the other day who had a wedding reception here, like 10 or 15 years ago, and people have really special memories because it's that kind of special place. So we want all those people to come back and see the revamped version, and hopefully they'll enjoy it as much as they have done before.
The biggest thing for me is, like, don't put anything in your mouth unless it's
delicious.
Full of flavour and delicious. Yeah. And that's what we want to do. We want to make people leave and go, wow, that tasted good.
Mm.
And Sam's food really is delicious as well. That's his main thing. That's true.
And one of the nice things about working on Flavour is getting to know the people that we interview and the follow-on stories that can often crop up. In this instance, one of the many plaudits that Restaurant 22 has won over the year is for the delicate microherbs and plants that tend to set off their dishes. And this is thanks to Jack and Mickey of the company Seed to Feed, two guys very passionate about their product.
Well, I met Jack. We're working at Elementum together. I was sous chef there and he ran away.
So, what do I grow? So I love sweet and nutty things. Like, I love brassica leaves. Got this really beautiful red Russian kale, which is like a serrated leaf, really small, sweet and nutty, beautiful colour red stem. Kohlrabi leaf, it's a purple kohlrabi plant, but that's the leaf just harvested off. Beautiful purple top Milan turnips.
I grow radish. You grow countless amount of cress.
I love growing pea shoots. Pea shoots are amazing.
I first found out about you when I was chatting with Alexandra Olivier and Sam Carter of Restaurant 22.
Wow, yeah.
A guy came to see me on Saturday. His name's Jake. He's got a company called Seed to Feed.
Your product adds this extra flavour and complexity to dishes, and that's something that you tend to find in the more high-end restaurants, I suppose?
Yeah. And it's all the little microcresses, radishes, baby turnips, mustard frills.
Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Yeah. We would be interested in meeting Jake.
I'll send him your details.
Yeah. Chef Sam has been really incredible. He's a really good guy. I went to him first because I saw what he was doing at Restaurant 22.
Yeah. He literally picks the cress that morning, brings it to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And it's beautiful stuff.
You put it on Saturday night, didn't you? The mustard frill, was it? And we had so many comments on it.
Really?
Yeah, just a tiny, tiny leaf, but so much flavour in it.
Like, as soon as you see the produce, as soon as you meet him, he looks a bit weird, but but like, you meet him, you see his passion for it, and it just, you fall in love with it yourself.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And yeah, I had no real interest, to be honest, in in like the growing of food and the like nurturing of food until I met you. Even when we was at Alimentum together, you were very much into growing things, the process of getting food from the farm to the plate.
Yeah.
I didn't really care. I just thought, I get good produce in, doesn't matter where it comes from, who's making it. And then you've sort of encouraged me to find out where it's from, to know the person that's making it, to know how they're doing it, know how things are done.
Are there any lesser considered herbs amongst the public that you guys would like to champion?
Mabuna.
Mabuna is an incredible crop. It's an Asian leaf. It's beautiful, really deep green in colour.
And the taste?
Oh,
peppery, sweet.
Yeah,
amazing.
Really good, yeah. Just incredible. One thing, so I forage as well. Sheep sorrel it takes about an hour to get a punnet, but the leaf is beautiful. Its flavour is really sharp, really citrusy, and they're really small, delicate leaves, and they're in the depth of the forest. Oh, it's perfect.
And that was just a sample of some of our features from 2018. And Green Onion signals the start of our new section, as ever, beginning with jobs.
And if you discovered that washing up is your forte over Christmas and New Year, then there's a real opportunity for you at Sala Thong, the Thai restaurant in Newnham Road. They want a part-time washer-up. Pop in to apply or phone Cambridge 323 178.
Doppelganger is opening its vegan restaurant in the old Cafe Cecilia premises in Regent Street later this month. Chefs are needed. Email your CV to hi@doppelgangerburger.co.uk or phone Alfie Fowler on 07709 452 791 for more details.
Fitzbillies needs a chef de partie. Pay is £8.50 an hour, depending on experience. 40 to 45 hours per week. No evenings, no split shifts. You can phone head chef Stuart on Cambridge 352 500 or email manager@fitzbillies.com.
And last but not least in the job section, Midsummer House needs full-time chefs at all levels. Pay is between £19,000 to £23,000 a year, and you'll be working from Wednesday to Saturday. Phone Cambridge 369 299 for details. And good luck if you're applying for any of the jobs we've advertised here today, and please mention that you heard about them on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bit of food news, if you fancy growing your own food, there are some plots available at Trumpington Allotments in Foster Road. To apply, email trumpington@allotments.net.
Coming up later in January is the opening of Thirsty and Hungry in King Street in the premises previously occupied by Urban Shed. Mark Poynton, ex-Alimentum, has a role overseeing the food, so it should be very good indeed.
Also, coming up in late January will be an announcement about the future of Newnham Bakery Cafe. It's being sold, but there's a press embargo as to who is buying it. We will let you know.
And if you're thinking of popping down to Bennett Street for one of Jack's gelatos, then don't. It's closed for a few weeks over the winter, and we will let you know when it reopens.
And another imminent temporary closure, Emerald Foods on the Market, who have taken over Michael Matthews' teas and coffees after his retirement, are open today, Saturday, and then again on Tuesday, but then they are then going on holiday and won't reopen until the 26th of January. So time to stock up.
Some events coming up at Cambridge Wine Merchants. On the 19th of January, Level 1 of the Wine and Spirit Education Trust Wine Course at the Cherry Hinton Road Branch. It's from 10 until 5 and it costs £150. It's run by Steve Hovington, who has done wine features on Flavour. The course is repeated on 21st January at the University Centre in Granter Place at the bottom of Mill Lane. Same time, same price. To book, go to the Cambridge Wine Merchants website.
And also at the Cherry Hinton Road branch of the Wine Merchants is a Burns Night Whisky Tasting. It costs £16.50. Tickets, again, available from Eventbrite or any Cambridge Wine Merchants branch, or you can phone Cambridge 214 553.
And finally, Heidi White has announced the dates of the 2019 Eat Cambridge Food Festival. The main event is on the 11th of May at the Guildhall. Fringe events run from the 11th to the 26th of May. And we'll be getting frequent news of the festival from Heidi here on Flavour.
And that's all the time we have for today, but there's plenty more to come from Flavour this year. We'll be here on alternate Saturdays at 1, repeated Sunday at 2, podcast early in the week.
If you want to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, contact us on Twitter @flavour105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today, at 2 o'clock, Women Making Waves with Linda Ness and Susie Thorpe. From 3 till 4, Cambridge Wish List. From 4 till 5, 105 this week. 5 till 6, the Cambridge Football Show, The Results. 6 till 8, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show. 8 until 9, Centuries of Sound. 9 till 11, Paul Cristoforou. And from 11 until 1 o'clock in the morning, Club Beats. But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 19th of January. So until then,
goodbye.
Goodbye.